Hi, Malcontents. This is Jennifer, and I'm here today with Lorena Gonzalez. She is running for Seattle mayor. Hey, Lorena, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Jennifer. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here with us and being willing to share your platform with our audience. Can I ask you what inspired you to run for mayor?
You know, I get that question a lot. It's an important question. Listen, I'm running for mayor of Seattle because I really believe in this city. I love the city of Seattle. And I know many people, including many of your listeners and watchers, do as well. I have spent most of my life working through many challenges. I first started as a migrant farm worker out in Central Washington, where at the young age of 8 years old, I earned my first paycheck picking cherries in orchards in Central Washington State and living in migrant farm labor camps. And I worked my way through that to eventually becoming a civil rights attorney here in the city of Seattle, representing women, families, children, and people in all sorts of civil rights cases, including in police brutality and racial discrimination cases across the state. And so for me, I want to be able to build on that work, on the work that I've been doing on the city council for the last 7 years, to really deliver on this civil rights moment, to make sure that we're producing equitable community safety. And I also want to address issues of deep poverty and inequity in our city that are largely on, racial lines. We live in a tale of two cities in many ways. And I think my unique lived experience and the fact that I'm still not benefiting from incredible wealth will serve the people well, particularly those working families and workers in our city who continue to be left out of our economy and who unfortunately end up entering into a cycle of poverty and homelessness. And I believe my record and my experience on the city council to deliver on big, bold, progressive ideas is exactly what the city needs in the next mayor as we come out of COVID and as we look at an equitable economic recovery.
And I think that's an excellent segue into our first question. Seattle is facing an ongoing crisis related to unhomed peoples. Washington State experienced a 6.2% increase in homelessness during 2019-2020. And King County spends over $1 billion per year in public and private investment in support of approximately 12,500 houseless people with very disappointing results. If you were elected mayor of Seattle, how would you address this crisis? And how do you think your plan would provide aid in resolving this crisis, both in the short and in the long term?
Because this issue is so controversial, I think it's important to really start from a place of acknowledging where we have common ground. I think that we actually agree on a lot in this space. I think in general, we all agree that we want to create a system and a community in which people aren't required to live outside because of lack of housing. Mm-hmm. We want to be able to use our parks as parks. We want to be able to use our sidewalks as sidewalks. And we want to be able to use other public spaces for their intended use. And we don't want people suffering needlessly in our streets. So I think, the reality is there are a lot of interventions, a lot of solutions, a lot of ideas that work. Permanent supportive housing, transitional housing, rapid rehousing, increasing non-congregate shelter options for people that'll meet their needs, and providing people with mental, behavioral, and substance use disorder treatment and services and healthcare that is linguistically, culturally appropriate is what we know works, and it's what we keep doing. The issue has been that we are in a little bit of a logjam because of a lot of different personalities who can't come together to set aside egos and to just get to work on those solutions. What is different about me is I have significant deep relationships with our city council, with our regional elected leaders, with our state elected leaders, and with our federal elected leaders to really make a difference in this space and to shepherd forward all of the solutions I just listed in a way that is going to produce more meaningful results. And so I'm looking forward to being able to lead in that fashion and to really, walk into that challenge with eyes wide open, but also taking advantage of all of the opportunities I believe exist about the areas that we agree upon as it relates to addressing the needs of people experiencing homelessness.
COVID, of course, has exacerbated the homeless mm-hmm. crisis, but it's also really something we need to discuss in the context of economic recovery and development, as well as addressing Seattle's crumbling transit infrastructure, such as the West Seattle Bridge. It's of great importance to many people. Moreover, some are expressing concern about large corporations and many in the workforce actually leaving Seattle. The question then is threefold. How do you plan on tackling infrastructure, aiding in economic recovery? And what concerns do you have about the loss of corporations and workers?
COVID is really, especially for communities of color, really highlighted some of the pre-existing inequities and made them worse. And I think that COVID has left no households untouched, assuming that, you don't live in the 1% in our city. Yeah. Most households have been impacted in some way. My household is no exception to being touched in a negative way by COVID. My own husband, who is in the restaurant industry, found himself unemployed for the better half of last year and most of this year, and just recently returned to work because his restaurant finally reopened. So I understand how important it is to support our local economy and to make sure that folks are going to be able to not just make it through the next few months, but to actually be able to thrive. So I think it's important to make sure that we are continuing to provide things like rental assistance and eviction relief and other supports to our local economy to make sure that they can continue to weather the storm and again, eventually get to a place where we are thriving. Reopening downtown is critically important. It's important because there are thousands of workers in the region that rely on those jobs. Hotel workers, retail workers, other, restaurant service industry workers, arts and culture workers, they all rely on a bustling, moving downtown. And that's why it's so important for us to continue to ramp up our vaccination efforts and to continue to following, public health guidelines to make sure we're not rolling back our economic restrictions. And so, I think this is a really complex issue. We have, a little bit more of a storm to weather here before we are going to start seeing some upticking, but we are seeing that people, including corporations in our city, are committed to being here. And I really appreciate those corporations who acknowledge that taking care of their workers is part of a good business strategy. And it means that they are going to continue to, in my mind, be good partners to us at the city to help us get workers back to work safely, but also to continue to be good neighbors and help us build the vibrant city that attracts their workers to come here in the first place.
And back to the question of infrastructure, for example, I was in mm-hmm. West Seattle the other day, and it is an absolute nightmare up there with construction, and there's so much being done. How do you plan on addressing issues of infrastructure, especially if we're looking at example of the West Seattle Bridge?
Well, I live in West Seattle, so you don't got to tell me more than once about the impacts of the West Seattle Bridge. It is the number one issue that people approach me about as I move about in my own community here in West Seattle. It is a regional asset. It is it was the right thing to close it down because of the significant public safety issues that it posed, but it is proven to all of us how important it is to maintain our infrastructure. Of course, the federal government is looking at funding infrastructure projects. It's a little unclear to us what bridges will be prioritized in that. But in the interim at the city, we are looking at strategies to make sure that we're taking care of our bridge infrastructure, including currently looking at a bonding proposal of up to $100 million to take care of much needed infrastructure need of bridges across the city. So that's going to be something that the next mayor is going to have to implement and execute on. And as a sitting city council member who's being asked to vote and consider this strategy, I'll be ready on day one to implement that as a priority to make sure that no other neighborhood in the city of Seattle is left effectively on an island and isolated and having to deal with the immense amount of traffic that's caused by rerouting. It has been really difficult for the entire region to deal with our failed bridge, and we can't allow it to happen again.
As a result of protests related to the murder of George Floyd, for which Derek Chauvin was just convicted on all three counts, police violence and ongoing racial inequality, Seattle has earned a national reputation as crime-ridden, dirty, and unsafe. At one point, it was labeled by the previous presidential administration as an anarchist jurisdiction. How do you plan on addressing the continuing racial inequality that exists within Seattle? And do these perceptions of Seattle as, you know, crime-ridden, in chaos, how do you plan to mitigate those and make people see Seattle more favorably?
I just want to sort of start by acknowledging how important it is to not only say the words Black Lives Matter, but to effectuate those words in our policy. And local jurisdictions are the ones who hold the most amount of power to truly transform policy to produce equitable community safety. And by that, I mean, we have control of our police departments. We have control of their budgets. And we have control of how we leverage our dollars to invest or not in community-based safety initiatives that will help to reduce, you know, the need to engage in criminal behavior because of a lack of opportunity. So I want to acknowledge that this is really important work. It is not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen in one mayoral term. It is long and steady work that is really important for the next mayor to fulfill and continue. I think that the reality is that, you know, Seattle continues to be a vibrant city. That doesn't mean that we are crime free. It does mean that that we have an obligation to make sure that we are meeting current public safety needs with the tools that we currently have, while also working on continued investment and scaling up of human service-based programs that are really going to produce more equitable community safety. And so that means that we're not flipping a switch, right? We're not flipping a switch overnight on 911 or pulling away from public safety services, but we are doing the slow and steady work of making sure that we are meeting the 911 response needs of the city while also investing in communities who have been starved of investment for far too long. And I think that that's just really important work for the next mayor to understand and to be committed to and to make difficult decisions about what our police department should and should not be doing in terms of their bodies of work is going to be a significant challenge for the next mayoral administration.
Thinking about the SPD, when compared to the West Coast cities of Portland, San Francisco, San Jose, Sacramento, Oakland, and San Diego, Seattle has the second highest cost per police officer tied with Oakland and the second highest officer per capita behind San Francisco. Additionally, the average officer makes $153,000 a year before benefits, according to the Seattle Times. Despite the large force and supporting budget, Seattle police report slow response times and claim the issue is a lack of staffing. The budget was cut approximately 18% and staffing levels were adjusted to support roughly 1,325 officers. How would you define defund the police and what is your position? And how do you restore community trust, especially within BIPOC communities in the SPD?
I started kind of answering that a little bit on that last question, but I think, you know, I think the concept of defund SPD is, for a lack of a better description, it's a oversimplification of the issue that we're talking about. And so I think it's really important for us to stay focused on a concept of what it looks like to scrutinize police budgets, which historically have not received scrutiny. And I know this, I can speak from a place of knowledge because I have served on the city council and it has been incredibly difficult to scrutinize the police budget in large part because there isn't a lot of transparency. I think it's important to start there, right? We have a responsibility to take a closer look at every city department's budget. And just because you're a police department doesn't make you exempt or give you the privilege to not have that level of scrutiny. The second thing is we're talking about an allocation and reallocation of city dollars to programs that will produce true equitable community safety. Things like gun violence prevention, things like youth engagement, jobs for youth, particularly Black men between the ages of 18 and 24. These are all programs that we know if we invest in them at the need that exists, they will make a difference. They will interrupt cycles of violence, and they will interrupt the cycle of poverty that oftentimes allows our children to be victimized by criminal elements. And so I think it's really important for us to have a conversation about sort of what does it look like to scale up programs that do not require a gun and badge to respond? And how do we get our police department back to core law enforcement functions that are appropriate for them to respond to? They are not equipped and don't have the tools, nor, I believe, should they be responding to people in mental health crisis with guns. We should be looking at how do we get to people who are experiencing mental health crises with better systems in place. And once we identify what those systems are, once we've developed those systems, we can start pulling back a law enforcement first approach.
Mental health crises has been one of the things that COVID has mm-hmm. shed so much light on. And we've recently had a man in the throes of a mental health crisis mm-hmm. get shot by SPD on the waterfront. And so would you be open to implementing something similar to the STAR program in Colorado, which replaces traditional law enforcement responders with a medic and mental mm-hmm. health professional for some emergency calls as a way to de-escalate situations when there is a clear mental health component?
I have great news. We have our own version of STAR in the city of Seattle. It's the Health One mobile unit. We are just announced that we have deployed our second unit. But again, that brings us to a total of two, and the need is much greater, obviously, than a total of two. But that model is exactly what you've described. It is designed to respond to people who are in crisis, who don't need to have necessarily a law enforcement intervention, but need somebody who's going to help them de-escalate and to approach them with the behavioral health needs that they need in order to, again, calm down, take a moment, and survive at the end of that experience. And so I think we need to do more of that kind of work. We need to take that to scale so that we are actually seeing good outcomes for the people who are experiencing mental health crisis. Obviously, somebody ultimately dying, being killed as a result of being in a mental health crisis, I think we can all agree that that is not the outcome we want to see. I don't think police officers want that outcome. And I don't think anyone else in the city wants that outcome as a result of that interaction.
So shifting directions a little bit, I want to talk about land use in Seattle. 80% of Seattle's land that is zoned for housing is zoned for single family housing. Over the last 5 years, most of the new construction has been centered in the 12% that supports high density housing. Developers and builders focused on small footprint properties with minimal parking and luxury appointments. Housing affordability is a major problem for Seattle, which you already referenced earlier. Do you support changing zoning rules for ADUs and more dense construction to alleviate the housing crisis? And what changes do you support?
Let's start with the fact that Seattle, as progressive as we are, is not immune from the vestiges of racial discrimination in our land use policies. And in fact, we still have de facto redlining across our city. And it shows up in the fact that we have effectively banned multifamily housing in a vast majority of the city. Exclusionary zoning laws, like those laws that exist in the city of Seattle have a direct connection to redlining laws. And so I think it's really important for the next mayor, and I'd be committed to doing this, to finally reforming our exclusionary zoning laws to allow for increased development capacity in every neighborhood across the city. We need more housing choices. And we, as people of color in the city, we deserve an opportunity to be able to live in a neighborhood of our choice. And that determination, you know, I shouldn't be excluded from living in a neighborhood by virtue of the fact that I have historically lacked access to wealth and capital and financing to be able to get into a home. Currently, right now, I think we can all agree it is way too expensive for anyone. In my neighborhood, it costs $850,000 to get a small three-bedroom house. Wow. And that is just not okay. And we have to allow for affordable housing development to occur in areas that aren't just restricted to urban villages. Everybody has a responsibility to do their part. We all should be absorbing development capacity, and we are way far behind the nation as it relates to this kind of reform. Even President Joe Biden has put as part of his platform the need to radically reform and abolish exclusionary zoning laws, and I couldn't agree with him more.
So Seattle has a reputation of having high taxes compared to other Washington city. A number of initiatives have added incremental taxes to fund transit, homeless programs, education, and the general fund. These taxes are small on paper, 0.1%, for example, but most of these taxes are regressive due to Washington state's tax structure. Will you pledge no new taxes on the citizens of Seattle?
I cannot make that pledge. I can make a pledge that I do believe in progressive revenue taxation. I have been a longtime supporter of progressive revenue taxation, and do believe that there are people and corporations in the city who can afford to pay more in taxes in the city of Seattle. And so I think that it's important for us to acknowledge that not all residents of the city are created equal, and we have to be able to craft any future progressive revenue to acknowledge that fact and to try to the greatest extent possible hold harmless our lowest income residents in the city so that we are not exacerbating the realities of our regressive tax system in the city of Seattle. Our tax code is upside down in the state. We have made some progress in the state legislature this year, which I'm really excited to see, the capital gains tax in particular. Mm-hmm. But I think that we need a lot of help and relief from the state to be able to truly meaningfully provide tax relief for those people in our city who are lowest income and who are being taxed at a disproportionate rate in comparison to our wealthy residents and corporations.
And we know that Seattle has been home to Native peoples long before settlements. Mm-hmm. But sovereignty is always an issue for both tribes that are nations that are federally recognized and those who are not, like the Duwamish. So as mayor of Seattle, how would you continue to support Indigenous sovereignty for Native peoples living with and around the Seattle area?
Tribal relations and representation within a mayoral administration are very important given where we are seated. And I think that, you know, we, through our Office of Intergovernmental Relations, used to have a representative who represented the interests of tribes and made sure that we were honoring those really important principles of conferring and consulting with tribes. I also think it's important for us to remind our colleagues at the state level and at the county level that they have an obligation to do that. We have a Native council member now, Councilwoman Deborah Juarez, and she has done a really tremendous job of making sure that policies are centering the needs of Indigenous people in our city, and of also leveraging her position to influence how other agencies that we work with relate to and interact with and do business with our Indigenous community. The last thing I'll say is that we have an Office of Economic Development. We have many public works projects. And I think it's really important for all of our public works projects to acknowledge whose land we are on. But I also think it's really important for us to, as part of our community benefits and community workforce agreements, make a commitment to hiring and creating economic opportunities, whether it's jobs or businesses, business opportunities for Indigenous people whose land we are benefiting from.
Thank you so much for answering that. I really appreciate it. And thank you so much for being here today. We look forward to sharing this with our viewers, and best of luck with the rest of your campaign.